Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
The Beatles!
Those circuses on the air!
The president does it.
Sometimes you feel like a...
That means that it is not illegal.
Sometimes you don't...
Tear down this wall.
Here's Johnny!
Hey, Luke. May the force be with you.
It was you, Kristen, who shot J.R.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Ah! We're not gay! Not that there's anything wrong with that.
John has been waiting a long time to take the reins.
My name is Dave Letterman. Last night, I became a father. Thank you very much.
Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
For the third time in 6 seasons, it's one goal achieved. The Chicago Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup. The Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup.
It's in time, and the Chicago Cubs win the World Series. The Cubs have done it.
And now, this is history.
You're going to need outstanding hosts.
With Dave Plyer.
It's a guy, but I love you.
And Dave Schwann on 720 WGN.
And live from the Skyline Studios is my pal Dave Schwann. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Dave. Good to see you. Always fun to do this.
Absolutely. How you staying warm these days, pal?
Oh, yeah. We get by, with one winter after another.
That's right.
Getting longer and longer, though.
You know, with all the political unrest going on right now, I thought I'd start off with this fun fact for our history segment. In 1854, the Republican Party was formally organized in Ripon, Wisconsin. GOP stands for...
Grand Old Party.
Yep, is the second oldest existing party after its great rival, the Democratic Party. It emerged in 1854 to combat the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which was threatened to extend slavery into the territories and to promote more vigorous modernization of the economy. With its election of Abraham Lincoln in 1860 and its success in guiding the Union victory, abolishing slavery, the Republican Party was based on businessmen, small business owners, professionals, factory workers, farmers, and African Americans. It was pro-business, supporting banks, the gold standard, railroads, tariffs, and to protect industrial workers and industry. That was the original platform of the Republican Party.
That is correct. And really, in some, to put it in a simple form, it was a progressive party.
Yes.
They were made up of people who wanted to see an end to slavery. There was a faction, a big faction in the North and the South, which said, well, let's just leave things as they are. And groups like this were the ones that led the way to say, no, we can't have this.
But then in 1861, so we're talking just 7 years later, when President-elect Lincoln arrived to take the oath of office in Washington, he did it very quietly and very secretly. There wasn't a lot of pomp and circumstance. Because already then there was a plot to assassinate him.
There was an attempt on his life. He came into Washington undercover.
He did.
Yeah, because there was word that there was an attempt on his life.
There was a lot of tension across the nation at that point.
Yeah, and of course, after he took office, really, the beginnings of the Civil War were already in place and throughout his presidency.
Quite a bit later, 1896, Chicago's Tootsie Roll was introduced by Leo Hirschfeld. Here's a classic Tootsie Pop commercial.
The world looks mighty good to me, 'cause Tootsie Rolls are all I see. Whatever it is I think I see becomes a Tootsie Roll to me. Tootsie Roll, how I want your chocolatey chew. Tootsie Roll, I think I'm in love with you. Whatever it is I think I see becomes a Tootsie Roll to me.
Mr. Owl, how many licks does it take to get to the Tootsie Roll center of a Tootsie Pop?
Let's find out. One, two, three.
How many licks does it take to get to the Tootsie Roll center of a Tootsie Pop? The world may never know.
You remember that spot, right? Classic. You know what? They've actually revived that again. Like, we've seen that commercial recently.
Yep.
They put it back out there.
And I remember a little jingle. Chewy, chewy, Tootsie Roll lasts a long time.
I love it. Look at you, Dave. keep your day job. All right.
Yeah.
1905, the Rotary Club was formed by four men in Chicago.
That's right.
The purpose of the Rotary Club is to bring together business and professional leaders to provide humanitarian services, high ethical standards, build goodwill, regardless of race, color, creed, religion, gender, or political preference. And there's almost 35,000 clubs worldwide.
Yeah. There's a plaque, I believe, on a building on Michigan Avenue that mentions that
the Rotary Club
is where it originated. Yeah.
I knew in the movie Catch Me If You Can, which I just watched a little while ago, it was very prestigious to be recognized because of the integrity behind that award.
Exactly. Yeah.
The 1950 Your Show Shows with Sid Caesar and Imogene Coca premiered on NBC. Who were their writers? You remember some of their writers?
Well, one of them, I believe, was Mel Brooks.
Mel Brooks, Neil Simon, Carl Reiner.
Reiner. And maybe a very young Woody Allen as kind of a beginner.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, you mentioned that show. That was my parents' favorite show.
Your Show Shows.
In the early 50s, yeah.
Carl's going to be 97. And I talked to him 2-3 times a year on the air. And we did talk once about Your Show Shows and writing on that show.
Well, it was very interesting, but... at the time, I was doing another show called, in the beginning of television, as a matter of fact, I did a lot of shows pre-1946, before the people had sets, the Maggie McNellis Crystal Room, the Marilyn Day Show, really crazy shows.
But it was variety. It was variety. It was singing, it was dancing, it was comedy, that type of thing, right?
Yes. And one show I started to do in the same time, the Show of Shows started, called the 54th Street Review. Myself and Hara Belafonte and a couple of wonderful girls who became big stars later were in that. And Sid was putting on this, it was called the Admiral Broadway Review for 1 year. And then the next year they were coming back as the Show of Shows. And Max Liebman had seen me on that show and invited me to come along as Sid's, second banana. And I was so pleased because Sid, as far as I'm concerned, was the greatest comedian that ever worked in television, ever did before or after.
So, you know, you were cast as an actor, but you became an integral part of a historic writing team that I don't think any television program have seen since. I mean, you think about Mel Brooks, Neil Simon, Mel Tolkien, Lucille Callan, Joseph Stein, Michael Stewart, and later on in Caesar's Hour was Larry Gelbart and Woody Allen, but... when I think about just the writing team alone.
I know. As a matter of fact, when I came on as an actor and I didn't do it, I was not invited into the writer's room until the third or fourth week. I was out in the hall while they were in, they figured I was just an actor. And I had always written my material and I knew I could contribute. So one day I came in and I said, I have an idea. And they said, what's the idea? I said, what about foreign movies? I knew Sid did the greatest double talk ever. Nobody could ever touch him. In my act, I did double talk. And I said, well, I'd never be able to do it on the show because Sid's the master. And I said, wait a second. If we did foreign movies, he'd have to talk to somebody. And I could be his. So they said, what are you talking about? I said, and I took a pack of cigarettes that were lying around. I went over to Sid. And in Italian double talk, I tried to sell him a pack of cigarettes. And he started to bargain with me, too much. And we they said, that's it. That became the birth of the foreign movies. And then I was in the writer's room from then on. And being in that writer's room was my college. I watched those great minds and those great, Tolkien and Brooks and Caesar and Callan and Tony Webster and Edward. And, then seeing Larry Gelbart, who was one of the masters.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And the other thing is, too, for a time in the 1950s, you were doing almost 40 episodes a year. So unheard of today with these shows doing 9 episodes, 13 episodes.
I know. And that was the first year was an hour and a half. Caesar's Hour, after 4 years of shows, they broke apart. Coca went and did her own show, and Caesar went to do his show. And he did an hour. And so that was...
It was like a break.
Yeah, it was a break. It was easy. But the hour-and-a-half show was amazing because it was done on time. It was a live audience, and we didn't tape it. It was whatever we did. If we made a mistake, it was on the air.
Well, I was going to say, what was a typical week like in preparation for this? Because you aired on Saturday night, so were you literally working Monday through? Was this a 6-day a week, 5 days for prep before you did the live show?
Exactly. As a matter of fact, we had a very great schedule. Accidentally, we had a great schedule. The show of shows was rehearsed on started on Monday. Sunday we had all started on Monday. Friday we had a run through, and Saturday we had four run throughs, and the last one being the last one before the show, the penultimate show, was a dress rehearsal, a full dress rehearsal, and we went on live
with an audience. Did you have your dress rehearsal with an audience?
No, the dress rehearsal without an audience.
So the first time any audience saw the material was actually live in the show.
Right.
Wow.
And the only reason we were able to get laughs is that after the first year, they put us into a big theater in Rockefeller Center and had a huge screen that they could see what we were doing. You know, we were tiny little people on the stage.
Sure.
And they saw everything on this huge screen that was adjacent to it. And the laughter was there. It was for real.
I bet. No, I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was. The show ended, and then you know, as I said, you never stopped working. You know, your first novel, Enter Laughing, was published in 1958, later adapted as a Broadway play and a feature film. You know, this was a big deal in and of itself, writing this fabulous novel.
Yeah, I think because the Army taught me to be a teletype writer, I could typewrite. So in the show of shows, there was a typewriter in one of the rooms. I used to sit down and write beginnings of plays, the cast of characters, and they were all funny. You know, I never went any past that, but that was the beginning of it. But I think my writing talent, I figured out the other day, I'm writing this new book. I think it came because my wife and I were married in the first year I was in the Army, and then we were apart for about 3 years. And we wrote letters daily. Sometimes I wrote as many as 3-4 letters a day. Once I wrote 15 letters, and I think that's where my writing began, because not only did I profess my deep love for her, but I also told her about what's going on in the mores of the time, and being humorous too, I write her, you know, some funny stuff.
And that's a great Carl Reiner. Gonna be 97.
I know.
This year.
He just keeps going and going and going.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology.
And now back to This Is History. 1972, a story you covered. President Nixon, in the final days of his historic week, long visit to China. That was a big deal, going to China.
It was for a number of reasons. One, it really did open up trade with China. Another reason why is because in the 1950s, Richard Nixon, as a congressman and then later as vice president, was one that was leading the anti-communist fight in the United States.
In the very beginning, yeah.
China is a hardline communist country since around 1948, 49, when Mao Zedong took over. Now he's meeting with them, in 1972.
It was a
big deal for TV because, technology was evolving to the point where they could cover the event live. I remember watching him arrive and having dinner in China.
Oh, that's cool.
In 1972.
To watch it.
That was a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely was. 1982, so was this, Dave, the final episode of the Lawrence Welk Show. Now, that was on for decades. Like, I know people remember it on Channel 9. You know, it was syndicated for years, but it was on ABC television first.
I remember watching it in my grandma's house in the
60s. Same here.
Yeah.
My grandma in the 70s.
Yeah.
And even early 80s.
Oh, yeah.
And you just better shut the hell up when Lawrence Welk came on the air.
Right. Right.
And you remember that famous close?
Good night. Until we meet again. Adios. Au revoir. I'll be the same. Every dream comes true. And now, till we meet again. Adios. Au
tonight.
I remember that most, actually, the music to close it, the music to open it, and the music to close it. It also meant we had to go home.
Oh, okay.
We were watching it at the grandparents.
Now, grandma has to go to bed.
Grandma's got to go to bed. 1997, smokers must prove they're over 18 years old to purchase cigarettes in the U.S., and now it's 21.
Yeah, it was 18 for a long time, and then they raised it to 21, really to try and prevent younger people from starting.
There's generations of kids who have never seen a cigarette commercial.
Oh, right.
I like to show my kids.
When they went away in...
No, from a historical perspective.
And, I remember watching bowl games, Dave, on New Year's Day, 68, 69. Mm-hmm. You know, that was January 1st, the first day that they could no longer be shown on TV. And they were commenting about it during the football games.
The last one aired on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson before midnight.
Ah, really?
It was before midnight. The very, very last one ever to air in the country. But I mean, when you look back, and I have a DVD that sometimes I play when we have people over in the bar and stuff. Like I'll put like old beer commercials on or old cigarette commercials and stuff like that. When you go back deep back to the 1950s, there were commercials that clearly it was doctors. Doctors prefer Camel or whatever it might have been.
Yeah.
It was recommended by your physician. Let's take a listen.
If you were to follow a busy doctor as he makes his daily round of calls, you'd find yourself having a mighty busy time keeping up with him. Time out, for many men of medicine, usually means just long enough to enjoy a cigarette. And because they know what a pleasure it is to smoke a mild, good-tasting cigarette, they're particular about the brand they choose. In a repeated national survey, doctors in all branches of medicine, doctors in all parts of the country were asked, "What cigarette do you smoke, doctor?" Once again, the brand named most was Camel. Yes, according to this repeated nationwide survey, more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. Why not change to Camels for the next 30 days and see what a difference it makes in your smoking enjoyment? See how Camels agree with your throat. See how mild and good-tasting a cigarette can be.
1988, Chicago Mayor Eugene Sawyer and a city council gave the rights to the Cubs to install lights and to play up to 18 night games.
Welcome to Wrigley Field for tonight's game between the Philadelphia Phillies and your Chicago Cubs. I'm Jack Brickhouse, and I'll be your master of ceremonies for this historic first game at night ever to be played at Wrigley Field. Now at this time, we direct your attention to the on-deck circle next to the Philadelphia Phillies dugout, as the Wrigley Field lights will be officially turned on. Now, to perform the honors, the Cubs are proud to have a true die-hard Cubs fan. At the age of 91, he perhaps is the oldest Cubs season ticket holder. In fact, he has been in attendance at just about every Cubs home game for the last 25 years. His first Cub game he saw in 1906 at the age of 8 when the Cubs and the White Sox played in the World Series. Ladies and gentlemen, here tonight, age 91, to officially turn on the lights at Wrigley Field is Cubs fan Harry Grossman. Harry, welcome. You have something you want to say.
Can I have your attention for just one moment? I'm very proud and privileged and very happy to be chosen the one who's going to turn on the lights. I'll be more happier if all the fans will join me like a Harry Carey, 1, 2, 3, and then say, "Let there be lights," and point your finger. All you fans deserve it, and you certainly earned it. 1, 2, 3, let
Boy, that was an amazing...
That was a huge deal. I mean, knowing for years, you never saw, I never saw Night Game. I never went out of town to see it.
Do you remember the group that was against the lights that called themselves Cubs, Citizens United for Baseball and Sunshine?
Yeah, you know what? Let me tell you something. And what was it about? Was it about them living in the neighborhood?
That and just the, maybe the
tradition
behind it.
They just wanted to preserve it?
Yeah, but it was the last Major League Baseball field not to have lights.
Yeah.
And I'd be honest with you, I think Wrigley Field is beautiful at night.
Oh, absolutely.
It glows.
Especially now.
It glows.
And the thing that gets me is, you know, you moved into this neighborhood. This baseball park was here before you. Just be warned. I don't want to hear your whining. You live a block away, you're gonna have people stumbling on your lawn, and you're going to hear some noise. Don't move here then.
I have a friend that lives in Wrigleyville, and they're there for that reason, because they love the Cubs.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
1991, Chicago's Bill Veeck was elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame. Legend here in Chicago.
One-of-a-kind guy. I worked with the late sportscaster Red Motlow many years ago at WFYR. And Red knew Bill and did some programs with him, spoke of him so very highly, as did everyone. You know, he was just a one-of-a-kind gentleman who was a fan. Yes, he was an owner, and yes, he was a manager, and yes, he was a businessman. But first and foremost, Bill Veeck was a fan.
We are not far away from baseball season. I can't wait.
Oh, please. Please. How many days until spring
Pretty soon.
Training?
It's coming up. It's coming up. Have a great week, Dave.
You too, Dave.